Hey everyone, my name is Thomas Daher. I've been an editor for Yes Theory since 2016, but most of you know me as Matt's little brother. And because I share a name with the co-founder of Yes Theory, which can get pretty confusing, I spent the past few years exploring some alternate identities, TD, which are my initials. But said quickly, it sounds like titty. And that became my nickname, which was funny at first. But eventually, it got kind of awkward introducing myself as Titty to strangers. So now, I go by Tommy. For years, I've been grappling with who I think I am and who I want to become. With Matt stepping down from filming and Yes Theory evolving, I'm emerging from the shadows of the editing room and going on new adventures. I'm excited, but I'm also terrified. I'm terrified because I never thought I'd be hosting YouTube videos, let alone hosting this podcast. But unlike Matt, Thomas, or Amar, I'm an introvert, which is why my first passion was video editing. Editing is an introvert's dream. As a 13-year-old, I would literally steal Matt's computer to edit videos on iMovie. And let's just say he wasn't pleased when he had to chase me down to ask where his computer was. While I love making videos, I never considered YouTube a legitimate career option. I mean, my dad's a doctor, and my mom and sister are lawyers. But then, Matt threw a curveball by starting Yes Theory.
Or a possibility for you.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Hello.
This is Matt.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. This is going to sound kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm on a 24-hour challenge with my friends. No money, no wallet, nothing.
What? Don't die.
And when I first started watching the videos the guys were making, I was a bit jealous. Making videos was my thing, my secret dream. And like that, I realized that studying math at McGill wasn't giving me that fire in my belly. But in November 2015, I got a call from Matt, asking if I could meet them at the train station to shoot a video. A week earlier, terrorists killed more than 100 civilians in Paris. Amar, Thomas, and Matt wanted to put a stop to Islamophobia before it got out of hand. So, I grabbed my film equipment and ran down to the station.
All right, well, yesterday, we showed you a video made by four guys in Montreal. Their goal was to show metro riders in the city that they are choosing love over fear in the wake of the Paris attacks. The video has gone viral.
Love over fear was the first video I worked on for Yes Theory, and it was huge.
Has gone viral. Two of them joining us now in Montreal. We have Thomas Bragg and Amar Candile. And good morning to both of you. How are you this morning, guys?
Good morning. Good, good.
Good morning. All right.
After seeing the video's impact, I felt that passion suddenly flicker inside of me again. It's really hard to have an epiphany around what you want to do and then have to sit another day in reality. But there wasn't much I could do to act on it. I was still only a sophomore in college. By the time summer rolled around, I was desperate for a perspective shift. I was going through a breakup, feeling unfulfilled in school for the first time, and craving a new direction. A question kept creeping into my mind. Is this really me? At the time, Matt was in LA shooting content for Snapchat. And one night, feeling completely overwhelmed and beaten, I Skyped him crying and told him about how desperate I was to escape. So Matt did his younger brother a solid. He asked Thomas and Amar if I could join the team for a month. It was a total pity invite, and they saw it as a favor to Matt, but I didn't care. Editing became this awesome opportunity for me to show my sense of humor, to speak without opening my mouth. And the guys liked what I was making, so they encouraged me to take a year off school and keep editing videos for them. Of course, I took them up on it. We pulled all-nighters, planned ridiculous stunts, and formed an unbreakable bond. I felt like a 2.0 version of myself. But it wasn't all that peachy. I couldn't speak to my parents without falling into a disagreement over when I was returning to school. So I figured out how to give them what they wanted without sacrificing my dream. I enrolled in a local college, editing all day and doing homework all night. For 2 years, I got about 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night to balance it all. But I would do it all again, because it allowed me to hold on to my relationship with my parents and my passion.
Out of all these episodes, which one that you would just not want to do?
I would never answer that question.
I know, that's what you'll make me do. So.
Oh, man. Eventually, Yes Theory pushed me beyond what I dared to imagine for myself. That turning point happened in 2018, when we visited Thailand.
Which one that you would just not want to do?
Probably abandon it.
Who wants to break the news to him?
All right, I guess.
No.
Oh.
Shit.
My
nervousness has increased.
Dude, this is the hardest country.
Amar, Thomas, and Matt encouraged me to step out of my comfort zone by stepping in front of the camera, to host a video. And the video title says it all. Introvert abandoned with no money in Thailand for 24 hours.
Let me clarify a few things here. The other guys, Matt, Thomas, Amar, they're all extroverts, which means they feed off of energy from other people. I'm an introvert, and I stay behind the computer, editing, making my little references, and that's where I'm, like, the most comfortable, and talking to new people just totally exhausts me. So for all you introverts watching...
While I usually keep quiet, this experience forced me to speak up and ask for help.
My friends challenged me today to go a full day in Bangkok. No money, no resources.
Give this guy some breakfast. What sounds good to you, man?
This one will be good.
You want that one?
Sure.
We'll do some scrambled eggs for this guy.
Right on, man.
Thank you so much.
Hey, yeah, what's your name?
George.
George, I'm Thomas.
After hosting that video, I realized that editing had been a safety crutch. For years, I watched from behind the screen as the guys pursued adventures. But here I was, on full display. I'm still seeking discomfort every single day, challenging who I think I am and who I want to become, exploring what makes me tick, on and off screen. And now, I'm ready for Thomas 3.0. Welcome to the Yes Theory Podcast. I'm Thomas Daher.
I'm Matt Daher.
I'm Amar Kandil.
And I'm Thomas Bragg.
We'll get into it after the break.
You decided to upgrade your outdoor deck, so you ordered the essentials: a power washer, a set of patio chairs, and a shiny new grill. And you used your Bank of America Cash Rewards credit card, choosing to earn 3% cash back on online shopping, or up to 5.25% as a preferred rewards member, which you put towards the cost of your most essential deck addition, a bird feeder. Apply for yours at bankofamerica.com/more rewarding. Copyright 2020 Bank of America Corporation.
From a math nerd to an editor to a host, I've reinvented myself over the years. You've probably changed in some significant way too. Maybe it was intentional and happened all at once, or maybe it was incremental and happened without even realizing it. But we all have opportunities to reinvent ourselves every single day. And I don't mean change who you are at the core. I mean choosing actions that better reflect who you want to become, the best version of yourself. We knew the perfect person to ask about the messy path to reinvention. Rich Roll is a podcaster, decorated vegan endurance athlete, and someone who's reinvented himself more times than you can track. The other Thomas, Thomas Bragg, aka T-Boogie, spoke to him.
Your journey of transformation is very inspiring for us. And so I would love for you to start with how you went from being an entertainment lawyer to becoming an Ironman and athlete.
I was always a very socially awkward kid who sort of felt like everybody else had the rule book for life that I was lacking. In elementary school and junior high school, I was definitely like the last kid picked for kickball. I was the kid who wore the headgear and I had an eye patch when I was in elementary school. And I struggled in school. The one thing in my life that I had some level of aptitude for as a young person was swimming. And that suited my introvert personality, because when you're in the pool, like, nobody can bother you. You're not getting bullied or anything like that. And I was pretty good. I wasn't like amazing, but I was pretty good. And when you're a young person and you're good at something, you're going to move in that direction.
When Rich was in high school, he doubled down on swimming.
Got into a club program and started doing the double workout thing. So I was literally waking up at 4:45 every morning. Wow. My dad would drive me to swim practice. I'd swim for an hour and a half, go to school. I'd go back to the pool after school and train for another 2 hours, come home, eat dinner, do my homework, crash by 9 o'clock. And that was my high school experience.
He wasn't really going to parties or dating, just school and pool. But all that hard work paid off. Rich was at the top of his class and one of the best swimmers in the country. So when he was scouted by a lot of schools, it came down to Harvard or Stanford. Rich wanted great academics and a solid swim program. And he knew that if he went to Harvard, I mean, come on, it's Harvard. But as a swimmer, he'd be a big fish in a small pond. Stanford, however, had the best swimming program in the country.
So the decision was go to Harvard and be one of the better swimmers in the program and go to this amazing institution that nobody in their right mind would ever say no to, or go to Stanford and roll the dice and take this risk, seek discomfort, and see what it would be like to train with the best in the world.
He chose Stanford.
And, you know, when I got to Stanford, that's when I discovered alcohol. I am very much that person who, you know, can remember vividly the first time I got drunk and feeling like, oh, this is what normal people feel like.
He managed to party, swim, go to class, and keep grinding. At his first major swim meet at Stanford, the only person who could beat him was the guy who was number two in the entire world.
And I did it with a broken rib because I was partying and got drunk and fell. So baked into that was this twofold thing. Like on the one hand, this guy has demonstrated that he can compete at this level, but also a foreshadowing of what was to come, because that whole rule book that eluded me now seemed to make sense. And I thought, this is my solution. Mm. And as they say, you know, in the halls of recovery, like it works until it doesn't work, or it works until it stops working. And for me, it worked for a long time. Like it taught me social skills. I became very social at Stanford. You know, I had kind of transcended this introvert personality disposition that I had, but, you know, slowly and over time, like it just became an unmanageable situation. It would be many years before I would be willing to admit to myself that I was an alcoholic, but all the signs were there, from, you know, cracking my rib to, you know, being the guy who is the last to leave the party. When you're young and you feel bulletproof, you think you can do it all. And with that, there's also an ego component. Like, I can go out and party till 3 a.m. and I can still get up at 6 a.m. and go to practice and kick ass and get good grades and all of that.
Ego is something Matt, Amar, and Thomas constantly check each other on. At the beginning of Yes Theory, they all read this book called Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday.
There was a Supreme Court justice who said, I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think ego is kind of the same thing, because it's different in different people.
That's Ryan. They sat down with him to understand what ego was. That way, they could learn how to break through it.
If you talk to a psychologist, they give you a very clear set of, like, a very clinical diagnosis of what that is. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, when you think you're better than other people, you know, when you think the world revolves around you. Yeah. I'm talking about that, and I'm talking about it sort of specifically, like, in real life, mm-hmm. right? You know, how it causes problems for us, how it, you know, destroys relationships, destroys careers. That's the ego that I'm focused mm-hmm. on. But I think we've all been the victims of it. We all can think of instances in our lives where it's caused problems for us, yeah. right?
Rich thought that he was bulletproof, that he could work hard, play hard, and never burn out. But soon, his ego started to destroy different aspects of his life, like Ryan warned. He was destroying the life he'd worked so hard to build.
And the truth of the matter is that after my freshman year in college, like, I never really swam fast again. I continued to swim through my junior year. I ultimately quit. And the only thing that was important to me was, where's my next good time? And all of these aspirations that I had about my life and all this promise that it held really got back channeled. And I had really lost a lot of that ambition. I thought I was going to be a doctor. I was pre-med. I stopped doing that. I was really just like, where's the party? And I just partied my ass off made almost no money, but had an amazing time. And that's where I think the drinking really kicked into a different gear. I ended up going to law school because I didn't really know what to do. And it seemed like something that was respectable and would make my parents happy. And it's amazing that I even graduated from there.
Rich got a job at a firm in Manhattan. It's a good drinking town. He could walk everywhere. But then,
you know, I got a job in San Francisco and my drinking continued to escalate through that. It wouldn't be unusual for me to wake up hungover and I would have a vodka tonic or two in the shower. And then I would have a tall boy between my legs and I would drive to work. Wow. And then I would like skip out of the office and like find a bar.
Addiction is a disease that presents differently from person to person. But as Rich mentioned, his ego played a huge role in his self-destructive lifestyle. Rich started thinking he could get away with more and more. Ryan reminds us where this behavior stems from.
You could argue that deep insecurity and ego are the same thing, because they're a focus on, what am I? What do people think of me? Am I good enough? You know, look at me. Give me what I want. To me, confidence and ego are the opposite.
Yeah. And what does confidence look like?
I think it's quiet. I think it's earned. I think it's based on experience. I think it's not sort of obsessed with the self.
The ego as man's tragic flaw is a tale as old as time.
It's hard to read history and philosophy and not sort of see ego as this sort of timeless theme. Like, you know, going back to the Greeks, the idea of hubris is like the sort of core, it's like the Achilles heel of most heroes and most stories.
Things started spiraling for Rich when he got a job at a firm in LA.
I got 2 DUIs in 2 months.
The first one, he rear-ended a woman, spent the night in jail. The second came with a bigger problem. Rich was out drunk driving one night. He said it was around 3 a.m. and he got pulled over. And Rich didn't know it at the time, but the cop who pulled him over knew Rich's boss. On Monday, his boss
calls me into his office. He's like, we got to talk. I got an interesting phone call over the weekend. He's like, I know that cop. He called me. Like, I've worked with him before. I was like, holy shit. I'm getting fired. He's like, I'm not firing you, but like, you got a problem, dude.
Rich's boss sent him to a guy named Charlie. Charlie was a legendary criminal defense attorney in LA. He'd been practicing for 40 years by the time Rich came to see him.
He goes, two things. First of all, you're an alcoholic. It's the first time anyone actually said that to my face. I knew it, you know, but I'd never admitted it to myself. And I'm not a miracle worker. You got 2 DUIs in 2 months. Like, you're going to jail. And I thought, I can't go to jail. Like, don't you know who I think I am?
Recognize that ego?
He's like, what do you want me to do? You got 2 DUIs in a row.
Charlie was right. Rich was most likely looking at jail time. But then, I guess, the universe intervened. Or, based on what you believe, maybe some bureaucratic mistakes swung his way.
They completely lost the file. And Charlie was like, I've been practicing law for 40 years. I've never seen that happen, ever. Like, there's no record that you got arrested over there. Wow. It's as if it never happened.
We'll pick up with Rich when we're back after the break. If you hadn't figured it out by now, Headspace is the headline sponsor of this show. And there's nothing I can say that hasn't already been said. But let me just remind you, the app has hundreds of guided meditation sessions on everything from stress to sleep. There are SOX exercises for meltdown moments and mini meditations for busy days. There are tons of tools for helping you become more mindful. Personally, Headspace has been a game changer for my creativity. On the super long back-to-back days of shooting or editing episodes, I need that time to reset, refocus, and reconnect. Stillness is the springboard for good ideas, and it helps me get into a better flow in all my creative pursuits. Basically, any random workday at the office, you can find me taking a quick nap in the afternoon, followed by a quick meditation to turn my brain back on. It's the best. So seriously, go check it out. Start your journey towards a healthier, happy life with Headspace. Download the app today for free. Rich Roll was practicing law in San Francisco when he got into some trouble with the law himself. His drinking problem had spiraled, and he got himself into not just one, but 2 DUIs. Luckily, there was no record of the first DUI ever having happened, so Rich was only prosecuted on the second DUI. It was bad, but it wasn't prison bad.
And that's like this crazy gift from the heavens that, you know, I choose to recognize as, you know, like a spiritual message from the universe. Yeah. Like, I'm giving you a little bit of a pass here, but that comes with conditions. Like, you gotta sort your shit
Wake up, yeah.
And I wish I could say that I was struck sober by that experience, but I wasn't.
His parents cut off all contact with him. He went to therapy. Rich would quit drinking, then would relapse, and then quit again, and then relapse again. His therapist offered to get Rich into a facility in Oregon, but Rich refused.
When I'm drinking around the clock until one day I wake up and I'm like, I can't do this anymore.
Rich called his therapist, and Rich's therapist called up the treatment center and booked his flight.
And I remember showing up, like I drank on the plane the whole way there. I show up completely drunk, you know, like I'm just out of my mind. I'm like, this is my last day. I've agreed to go to treatment. Like, I got as drunk as I possibly could because I was like, this is it. This is the mind of an alcoholic, right? I get there and it dawns on me the gravity of my situation. Like, I like to think of myself as a smart person. I went to Stanford. I did all these things. But the truth of the matter is that my best thinking landed me in a mental institution. That's the truth, right? And I was sort of waking up to that.
Struggling to admit our own fault, though, whether it's a major fuck-up or a minor mess-up, doesn't really serve us well. Not only can it sour some of our closest relationships, but it can even be detrimental to personal growth.
And I just remember thinking, like, I have to make this work. Like, I don't ever want to be in this place again. And if I want to get well and change my life, I really need to do what they tell me to do here. And so I made the decision to be honest, and I opened up and told the counselors there everything that I was doing. For the first time, I'd never really divulged any of that. There was so much shame about how I was living my life. And I unburdened myself of that.
Around the end of his first 30 days,
one of the counselors was like, listen, you have a case of alcoholism that we typically only see in lifelong drinkers, like people in their 60s. You know, I'm 31. And he's like, you're going to die if you don't get this right. We would strongly suggest that you stick around. And I just said, I'll do whatever you think. I'll stay as long as you think I should. And I ended up staying for 100 days.
After those 100 days, he went back to LA. And this time, Rich had something to prove.
I got to get back on top again. Like, I need to repair all these relationships that I damaged. And I need to become a productive member of society again. And I need to, like, kick ass at my job and, you know, become this person again who had the world, you know, at his feet. And I pursued that relatively blindly with a very workaholic mentality. It was all fueled by ego.
Even though Rich wasn't drinking anymore, he was still an addict. Over the next 10 years, workaholism took the place of his alcoholism.
I was doing well as a lawyer. I had this new life and a strong foundation in sobriety. I'd gotten all the stuff back. I'd repaired all the relationships. I was in good with my family again. I had, you know, great friendships, all of that kind of stuff. But I really just wasn't looking after myself physically during that period of time. And despite the fact that I'd been this athlete in college, I'd moved very far away from that. I'd put on 50 pounds.
While Rich didn't really take care of himself, his wife, Julie, had committed to self-improvement. She practiced yoga, ate mostly vegetarian, and read tons of personal development books. Despite Rich's professional success, Julie could tell that he was struggling on a personal level.
But every time that she would say, hey, read this or do this, like, I would recoil. You know, like, if you're in a relationship with somebody and they're like, I want you to do this or this is in your best interest, like, I don't know about you, but I'm like, no thanks.
After rehab, Rich was done with internal work. But this was a red flag for Julie.
Like, she became frustrated to the point where she had to think, like, I'm trying to grow. This guy doesn't seem to be that interested in growing. Like, do I really want to be in this relationship?
Until one night, he had a moment kind of like that second DUI. It snapped him out of the breakneck pace his life was going in. He was coming home late from the office again and
hit the Jack in the Box drive-thru on the way home, you know, just inhaled a couple double cheeseburgers or whatever it was, you know, got home, family's asleep, and I'm going upstairs to go to sleep. And I had to pause halfway up a simple flight of stairs. Like, I couldn't walk up the whole flight of stairs without taking a break because I was too winded. And because 8 years prior, I had had that experience of waking up and saying, today's the day I'm going to go to rehab and get sober, I was hyper aware of how powerful these kind of moments are. I think we're all blessed with moments like this in our life. We're just not paying attention enough to really take advantage of them. It was like the seas parted or this line in the sand moment where I realized, like, I feel that same sense of willingness. And if I take action on this right away, maybe I can make another big change in my life. And I think it's only because I'd had that sober experience that I was able to have the wherewithal to recognize that in that moment. I needed to do something kind of radical and very specific to harness the motivation or the kind of momentum that I felt in that moment. So the next day, I told my wife, like, I want to do a juice cleanse.
By this point, Julie was so used to hearing Rich talk about everything he was going to change that she wasn't having it.
So when I said, I want to do the juice cleanse, she's like, oh, well, you figure it out, you know? And I think I sensed that vacuum, like, suddenly, like, oh, like, wait, I have to take responsibility for my life? And it wasn't like, oh, I need to detox my body or this is like a healthy thing to do. It just seemed hard. Yeah. It was like getting in a Wim Hof ice bath or it was like detox. It was like going to rehab for food. Like, I need to shut it down and like reboot the operating system. So I did that. It was really hard for a couple of days. I'm laying on the couch, like literally like I was detoxing off of heroin. My wife was like, wow, look at him. It looks like he's in pain. But by the sixth, seventh day, I started to feel better and I felt amazing at the end of this experience. I felt like, how do I have all this energy? I've barely eaten anything. And it kind of started to piece together this equation between food and energy. And it was such an epiphany that I thought, like, how do I find a way of eating that is going to make me feel like this all the time? Because I feel amazing right now. And I realized the one thing that I hadn't tried was like, what happens if I just eat 100% plant-based? So I gave it a go. And, you know, very quickly, within 7 days of making that switch, I felt like I did on that last day of that juice cleanse. I felt amazing. And because I had all this excess energy, I started exercising again because I couldn't sit still. Like my foot was tapping and my wife's like, get out of the house. You know, she bought me a bike for my birthday and I went back to the pool and pulled an old pair of running shoes out of the closet and started jogging a little bit here and there and just enjoyed the process of reconnecting with my physical body for the first time in a very long time. And it reminded me of how much happiness that brought me as a young person because I just love swimming, you know, and I was like, I love this. This is like part of who I am. Why have I been denying this for so long?
Rich went from making decisions based on how everyone else would view him to doing something he enjoyed just for himself. That's a mistake most of us make in trying to transform ourselves. We do things we think we should do, not the things that we love and make us feel free. That was Rich's edge. He was only doing things he loved.
3 or 4 months into this whole thing, and I've been running a couple times a week for 45 minutes, 5 miles, 6 miles, something like that. And I went to go do this run on a trail near my house. So I was like, I'm just going to bang this run out. And it was just one of those days where time disappeared. I felt bulletproof, like I could just keep going. And every mile felt better than the mile before. Like I had this unlimited reservoir of energy. And I just kept going and kept going and kept going until I thought, this is probably really unwise now because I'm really far from my truck and I didn't bring any water or anything like that. Wow. I was out there over 4 hours and I'd never done anything like that before in my life. And I thought either I've just unlocked some dormant gene that I didn't know that I had, or these lifestyle changes that I've met, dietary, whatever, are having a bigger impact on me than I realized. And I just made a commitment to myself that I was going to keep doing this because it made me feel good, not because it made logical sense for a 40-year-old man to be spending an inordinate amount of time like running around in the canyons. So it wasn't a rational thing. It was just an emotional thing. I didn't set any goals for myself. My only thing was like, I like being outdoors. I like the way the sun feels on my shoulders.
This 24-mile run in the Los Angeles canyons carried the same sense of transcendence as a spiritual experience for Rich. In fact, our ego expert Ryan says that when you go off into the wilderness,
it would be very hard to be egotistical standing at the bottom of that canyon or looking down into the bottom of it because you realize how tiny you are and how little you matter. I think there are ways to go out and humble oneself.
That experience steered Rich away from his workaholic lifestyle. No longer desperate for external affirmation, he started a new journey, becoming an ultra-endurance athlete.
I thought like, oh, well, maybe I'll do some races. Like if I can run 24 miles, I can do a triathlon. So I signed up for this race called Wildflower, which is a half Ironman race, and just trained on my own and did what I thought I should do, not knowing anything about anything. And it was kind of a disaster. Like I was vomiting on the swim and like cramping up on the bike and barely finished the bike and then tried to run and could only run 100 yards before I like just said, I can't do it. You know, like it just ended. So once again, like there was no like, oh, this guy's going to, you know, go on and do interesting things in this world. Like, no, it's not happening at all.
You didn't finish.
No, wow. I didn't finish at all. I spent the whole day watching people pass me. I mean, it's like, you know. It's like,
But Rich, a man in the midst of reinvention, didn't take this as a hit to his ego. He embraced the humility that washed over him when he strove towards these superhuman physical feats. After all, this wasn't just about finishing. Rich had discovered a new sense of self when his body was in motion, something that he wanted to tap into further.
And I stumbled across an article in a magazine about this race called Ultraman that I'd never heard of, which is a double Ironman, 320-mile, three-day triathlon that circumnavigates the Big Island of Hawaii. I think the real trigger for me was that in reading about this race, Ultraman, is that it was a world championship event, and certainly there were athletes that were vying for the podium, and et cetera. But it was described more like a spiritual odyssey. And what I realized is that endurance sports and this new world of ultra endurance is this incredible vehicle or crucible for personal growth. I needed to learn more about what made me me. I needed to go on this journey of self-discovery. And because I had this disposition or this acumen for these kinds of physical activities, I felt like that was the path for me to learn more about who I was. Some people go to Tibet, you know, or they meditate in a cave or whatever, you know, like this was my version of that. Mm-hmm. So as athletic and difficult as it was to train and compete in these races, for me, it's always been about what I learn about myself as a result, rather than like the accolades or the physical fitness aspect of it. I was able to deconstruct my story and realize that so many of the decisions that I've made were not for me, but were for others.
Rich was hooked. He trained his butt off for an entire year and got into the best shape of his life at 43 years old. And then he went for the Ultraman.
You know, it's probably still, like, to this day, the highlight, you know, of my athletic career.
But on the second day, where he cycled 130 miles, his bike pedal snapped.
It just cracked right off the crank. And it was the one section of the race where they don't allow your crew vehicles to follow you. So I had to walk my bike or pedal it on one leg for like a mile to reconnect with my crew. And during that 1 mile sort of jaunt by myself, I just was like, I'm done. Like, I got a broken pedal. I can barely bend my knee. It's all banged up. It's swollen already. Like, this is over. I started thinking about the hotel bed that night and taking my kids to the beach the next day. And I was like, that's not so bad. And when I reconnected with my wife and my sons who were crewing me, and there were all these other crew vehicles there, you know, I hugged my wife and I said, it's over. And a crew member for a competitor looked at my bike and he's like, what kind of pedal do you need? I said, why are you asking me that? And he disappeared and he came back and he had a brand new pedal, the exact make and model that I needed to fit my cleat. And he took my bike and he put it on and he's like, get back on your bike, dude. I was like, you don't understand. Like, I'm done. You know, like mentally, like once you flick that switch and you checked out to get back in the game, I was like, that was not what I wanted to hear. And there's all these people looking at me and I was like, I guess I have to get back on my bike.
Rich relearned an important lesson he'd picked up in rehab. The real test of strength isn't about when everything's going right. It's about when things are going wrong.
And when everything goes right in a race, like, it's great for the ego, but what do you learn? You don't learn a whole lot. Mm-hmm. It's when things don't go right and you're forced to make decisions that start to, you know, reveal your own character and like what you're truly made of. And the fact that I was in that situation where I wanted to quit and because of another person was compelled to continue on, that I was able to confront myself in a much more profound way than I would have had everything gone great. And I learned more about my own capabilities and myself than I would have under any other circumstances. If you're feeling uncomfortable or you're waiting like, oh, I'll do that when I feel like doing it, that's the wrong way. Mm-hmm. If you want to change your state, you take the action first, irregardless of how you feel about it. So to me, like, the universe delivered exactly what I was looking for, and it was perfect, and I wouldn't change anything about it.
I've always been searching for these inflection points that galvanize change. For Rich, it was a DUI, or walking up the stairs out of breath. These epiphanies don't come knocking on our doors often. They visit us sporadically, and when they do, we don't often welcome them. That's because they confront the ego head-on, which is super uncomfortable. Like for me, being forced to go up to strangers in Thailand reveal that I care a lot about what other people think of me. With editing, I'm able to take my time thinking about how to make someone laugh or get my message across. But talking to people on the spot, it stirred up a lot of discomfort because I didn't know who I was in this new extroverted role, my ego deflated, and it was replaced by humility, like the feeling Rich has after his run. Chances are, you've had some type of epiphany during the pandemic. Maybe it happened after you moved back home, started a new hobby, or had an argument with your quarantine partner. And chances are even more likely that you've totally ignored it. So our challenge for you this week is to turn away from your ego and towards humility. Here are some tips from Ryan.
Working on shit that challenges you is a really great way to keep your ego in check. Like, one of the great things about writing is that it's really hard and that you're starting from scratch every time. And so you wake up and you're just sort of humbled by the profession. Like golf, it's such a humbling game, right? Like, the harder you try, the shittier you are, you know? So like, focusing on craft, challenging yourself, not getting complacent, that's one way to do it.
You can journal about a moment you've fallen short. Ask your boss for honest feedback on when you can improve. Ask a loved one how you can show up for them. And then commit to acting out of love and humility, rather than ego. Share how you're deconstructing your ego with us on Instagram by tagging YesTheory and using the hashtag YesTheoryChallenge. I'm your host for this episode, Thomas Daher. I wouldn't be here without Amar Kandil, Thomas Bragg, and Matt Daher. This episode is produced by Joy Folks and Juliet Luini. It was edited by Joey Fishground. Dan Kroll sound designed and mixed it right up. The Yes Theory podcast is produced by Kate Ward for One Day Entertainment. The executive producers are Leah Sutherland, Morgan Seltzer, and Sam Rogaway from Headspace Studios.